All right, everybody, welcome back. I'm Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly High Performance Human podcast. Hey, listen, I'm pretty certain in the last few months you've come to value your health and fitness as much as I have. Personally, for the last few years, I've been slowly adjusting my approach, not just in the way I conduct my own training, but the way in which I coach other people. And it's one where health and human performance has come before race fitness. Now, the two are inextricably linked, but what I've become more aware of is how good performance cannot exist without good health. And the whole coronavirus outbreaks just reinforce this belief. In 2020, we might have had our racing interrupted, or it might have been erased completely, but that's not stopped us, has it? We've carried on. I know for sure that many of you found new ways to stay active, and hopefully, like me, you've started to enjoy the process and discipline of daily exercise, and that have given you new purpose. That's not to say we won't embrace the opportunity to race when we get the chance, but I think when events like COVID-19 challenge our health and enjoyment, we start to realise what is truly important. In future podcasts, I'll be sticking occasionally to the triathlon theme. But more importantly, I'll be looking at this whole subject of the high performance human. And I hope you enjoy the new lens which we're looking through. And it will definitely be my goal and my pleasure to share information which will educate you and enable you to achieve your potential as a human being first and then an athlete, and help you to create the foundation to be the best version of yourself. Whether that's triathlon, ultra running, cycling, open water swimming, whatever you like. Human first, then athletic performance. Anyway, enough of what's coming up in the future. Let's get back to the present and crack on with today's guest. Hey, everybody, welcome back. He's one of my favourite Yorkshiremen. He's back. He's all the way from New Zealand, Dr. Dan Plews. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Good to be back, Simon. Is this my third or fourth now, I think? Third or fourth?
Yeah, at least three, maybe four.
Does that mean I'm your most returning visitor yet? You've had Phil Mathetone and Prof on a few times.
Yeah, I've had the Prof on three times. One of them was a small one that we did. But actually, there was one that you and I did with him in Kona, one of my first podcasts. Yeah. There was a short one I did with him at the endurance conference at Training Peaks thing in Boulder. I think I might have done two. I did one in Kona with him on my balcony. I think we've done an official one. So he might be four. You might be equal now.
Equal. Oof. You've had some good guests on recently, though. I have to say, you've got some real big hitters. I'm a small fry now compared to some of your guests.
Do you know what though, Dan? When I send out a link to the podcast and people come back, they always comment on the quality of the guests, and your name props up quite a lot actually. So,
that's nice.
Don't be too humble.
No, that's nice to hear.
Anyway,
I have enjoyed them recently. I've got a new car, and I've finally got Bluetooth set up, so now I can listen to you in my ears as I drive along.
Well, I'm pleased that you've chosen me to be one of your podcasts. I'm sure that you listen to plenty of others.
No, I do listen. It's good. I just like your Yorkshire tones. So,
Well, we've probably got a few new listeners, Dan, who haven't heard any of the podcasts before. So for those of you who are in that category, I will link to the other conversations that Dan and I have had. But for those of you who don't know Dan is a Yorkshire lad, as you might be able to pick up from his accent. And Dan and I have known each other for, 20 years. I'm embarrassed to say that I was Dan's coach for a couple of years. And as I've been fond of quoting the founder of LinkedIn, if you're not embarrassed with the first version of yourself, you started too late. When I look back on the coaching I did then with Dan and his knowledge now and everything, I think, oh no, did I really do that? But anyway,
it was so long ago, I can't remember. So, and also don't forget, you were one of my first tutors in coaching generally, because you coached me to my British Triathlon coaching courses as well. John Dargy.
Yeah. That takes us back probably beyond 20 years. So that shows you how long I've been tutoring. So Dan was tipped for the top as a triathlete, weren't you? We discussed this in the last podcast at 17, and then you sort of, things changed and you ended up getting injured and it sort of passed you by a little bit. But unfortunately, triathlon's loss has been the physiology and heart rate variability world's absolute gain.
I guess the days when I was like 15 to 17, I was Yeah, I was actually talking to my dad about it the other day. Like when I was 15, it was the national championships at Market Bosworth, the national sprint championships. And at 15, I came 11th overall. I was just looking up the other day, which is, that's pretty good. But yeah, it was the undoing of me more than anything was I actually took a year out. I don't know if you know this story, but I took a year out because it was my last year as a junior. And my aim was I wanted to get a medal at the World Junior Championships. And what happened was in that same year, the whole of the age groups changed. They moved they moved it down to a sprint and they shifted me into a first year under 23.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much the end of it, really. It just derailed me. I took a year out for no good reason. And so got into the study instead, I guess.
Yeah, and but we should talk about your athletic prowess, Dan, because you never really left the sport, did you? You came back to it. And for those people who didn't know your early pedigree, it might have been quite a shock to them to see you coming back and posting these amazing performances at Ironman New Zealand, winning your age group there, and then going on to win the age group world championship in Kona 2 years ago and setting a world record, but more importantly to you, holding the title of fastest ever Yorkshireman in Kona.
Yeah, for sure, exactly. And Alistair's got, he's got to wait. And it's quite good, this COVID thing, because now I get to hold on to it for just that little bit longer as well.
Yeah, well, he's still got to get under 8:24 and a bit.
8:24, yeah.
Yeah, that still takes some doing.
And that's the thing. In hindsight, I wish I'd seen my strengths a bit sooner and swapped to the longer distance when I was a lot younger.
Mm.
But yeah, like definitely that distance definitely suits me a lot more. And remember one of the coaches at Loughborough, when I was at Loughborough University, Dan Salcedo, who he told me, I remember having a meeting with him and Ben Bright, and Dan was like, I really think you're better suited to the longer distance. But at the time, I didn't want to hear it because I just wanted to do, the Commonwealth Olympics and that kind of thing. But maybe I should have listened. Well, just too stubborn.
Well, with that sort of talent, Dan, I mean, 8:24 at the age of 28 would have got you in at least in the top 10 in the pros, wouldn't it? Maybe a bit higher.
Yeah, it would. Yeah. There's it's all hindsight. I think one of the main things that, everyone has mentors, and I'm obviously a physiologist and a coach, but there's a coach here in New Zealand called Gordon Walker. He's actually the coach of the women's. He's the coach of the women's kayak program, and he's won. So, like in New Zealand, in the UK, you have the Sports Personality of the Year, and you have the Coach of the Year. So, in New Zealand, we have the Hallberg Awards, which is the same equivalent. And he's won Coach of the Year at that three times. Mm-hmm. But he's the coach of the Olympic champion Lisa Carrington. But he's the one who probably taught me a lot. Well, he's not probably. He is the one who taught me a lot about. Coaching and training specifically for long distance triathlon, because he'd done a lot of multi-sport. He'd won coast to coast two times. He trained a lot with Cameron Brown. Yeah. And I have to say, of all the people who have kind of mentored me and taught me the most about training, yeah, he would definitely be the one.
Anyway, just before we go on to all this sort of physiology stuff, I've got a more lighthearted sort of quiz for you, Dan, because as good coaches, we have to have a warm up. I sent you these for a bit of prep, so I hope you're ready for them.
I had a quick read of them. They were quite difficult.
Yeah, that's what most people say. I've had some strong characters on recently. Some very knowledgeable people, and they've been stumped by some of the warm-up questions. But anyway, let's see how quick you get through this. So these are two or three just to get you going. So Pepsi or Coke?
It's not even a hard one. Pepsi. It would be Pepsi Max, actually. I used to pump the Pepsi Max when I was a lot younger. Obviously, I haven't had a Pepsi or a Coke in years now, but I just love Pepsi Max.
I was trying to think as well of the, when you were, you were brought up, Dan, you were an 80s kid. So Blur or Oasis?
Another easy one, Oasis.
Yeah,
still listen to Noel Gallagher on my Spotify.
Yeah. Pizza or burger?
Pizza. A bit carby though. Can I get a cauliflower low carb pizza in there?
No. No. We're going Yorkshire pizza here. full thick deep pan with a filled up crust.
Pizza Hut deep fried
with a cheesy crust as well.
You know,
the filled crust. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was trying to think of what films. I thought Top Gun and Pretty Woman might have been around your area. So Kelly McGillis, Top Gun, or Julia Roberts, Pretty Woman.
You know, it is a bit early, but it would. I've seen them both, obviously, but it's easily Top Gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. That's not a hard one either. These are the ones that I looked at. I went, oh, easy, 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 easy.
Yeah, well, I wanted to warm you up with some easy stuff before we start picking the pace up. So, you know, you've been to Kona, you've been to the awards, you've sat at the front there and waited for your opportunity to go and get your Amici Bowl. You know, when Riley comes on and he's got that Bubba Riley, the Who song when he walks on the stage. So when you're walking on, what's your signature tune to walk onto?
Have you heard of Not Many by The Scribe? Have you heard of that song?
Not yet, but we'll put it on the show links.
It's a good one. It's a bit, it's quite funny. I listen to it when I'm on the trainer and me and Terenzo Bazzoni, when we're training, we always kind of quote that song. Have a listen and then you'll realize why it's quite funny.
Yeah, okay.
It's a good
one. We'll put that on the show notes and then we'll see how many people pick it to go on their turbo tunes.
Yeah.
Okay. Cartoon character that most resembles you.
Well, this is a reasonably easy one. When I was in the UK and I used to race for Total Fitness Nottingham, the guys there used to call me Danny Bravo, because at the time I had a big, you know, I have a quiff and I was kind of more of a swimmer's build and I had like shoulders and skinny legs. So it still has to be Johnny Bravo.
I'm not sure I remember what he looks like. So,
you know. Oh yeah, people, he's quite the character.
Okay, another show link for us. What about your favourite motto?
I think the thing that I always find myself quoting a lot when I'm talking to athletes and coaches is context before content. I think that's my motto, because in the idea that, you know, we all put things down on paper before really thinking about the situation of what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing that springs to mind, because the amount of times I've said that in day-to-day life is unbelievable. So I thought about thinking of something a bit more stoic, but you know, to be honest with you, that's the thing that I probably do say the most.
So. Somebody quoted me that there were some of the candidates who are on one of our level 3 courses recently, and they were doing a little podcast and they tagged me in the post for it. And they then made a comment about reference to our key tutor, Simon Ward. And I thought, I'll have to go listen to this then, see what they were, because there were lots of little smiley faces. And one of them was asking, well, what have you been telling your athletes to do during lockdown? And he said, well, to quote our Yoda, Simon Ward, it depends.
Yeah.
That's another one that seems to be a favourite amongst coaches, doesn't it? And again, it's down to the context of...
Yeah, another one that I quite like recently, and I actually got it from... I heard it from Jan Frina, but I've used it a few times, is there's no such thing as a hack. You've just got to hack away every day.
Yeah.
You know, that's just so good, because I think, like, especially as a sports scientist and in the modern day world, everyone talks about biohacks and, yeah, everyone's always looking for the simple result, and you know, and it's just not, there's no such thing. You're just gonna do the same thing every day and have good routine, good consistency, and that gets you through. And I think that's, for any athlete, that's one of the most important realizations you have to have.
Yeah, I tend to agree there. And you know, you only have to pick up a men's fitness magazine or a triathlon magazine today, and it says 10 diet hacks to get you in shape tomorrow, 10 fitness hacks to build a bulletproof FTP by next Friday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just, man, it's not, no such thing, right? So,
yeah. All right, so you've done a lot, Dan. We were just talking about your favorite film, babes. But what about if they made a film of your life? Which actor would be playing you?
I don't know. That's a really difficult one. I wanted to say Zach Galifianakis,
but only because you're the only one who can pronounce his surname.
Or Will Ferrell. No, I don't really know. That was one that stumped me. Maybe I should get someone like Christian Bale, because, you know, as you go through different phases of your triathlon career and you get in your off season, you put on a bit of weight, and then you get into your Ironman race weight, you kind of get more towards the machinist. So he's, at least, you know, he's got the ability to just to change his body shape on the
He, if you saw Vice, did you see that film about Dick Cheney?
Yeah, he's amazing. I
mean, he was so overweight there, and then, like you say, when you see him in The Machinist, he's anorexic. Yeah.
He's one of my favorite. He's definitely he's my favorite actor. And cigarettes and coke—that's what he lived off for.
Really?
For The Machinist, that's how he got into that weight. He just had cigarettes and coke.
But you know, as a physiologist, you'll probably be able to answer this: is what stress does that put on his whole body, and what impact does that have on his long term health? Those constant fluctuations in weight.
That sort of thing is not good for your long term health at all. It just means that you're. It means that you put on weight much more readily when you go up and down like that. So I've seen it a lot in lightweight rowers are the same. Like, because I worked in rowing for so many years, and their ability to, you know, really starve themselves and then put on weight as soon as, literally, it can be a few days. It seems that they'll finish their last race, and then like a few days later, they're completely different people. It's like three. It's crazy. So
yeah.
So I wouldn't. That's kind of a hard one. The actor one.
Yeah.
Depends what it is. If it's a comedy, or if it's a drama, or is it?
Well, tell me the name of the first person you said again. The guy with the Greek name.
Zach, isn't it Galifianakis?
What's it? I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm impressed with your ability to pronounce so early in the morning.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong.
let's go on something a bit more simple then, Dan. I mean, in terms of Ironman triathlon, you do have a bit of a superpower there. But if you could take one of those otherworldly superpowers, which one would you have?
Yeah. Well, I always find. I always would think it would be awesome to have a photographic memory, you know, just to remember apps. You know, have you watched Suits? I mean, he's got, you know, Suits with Mike Ross, the guy in there who's got the, I would love to have that superpower. But for people who don't know, I'm actually a real superhero nut. I've been obsessed with superheroes growing up. I used to be on. That was one of the first things I ever wanted to do, was be a comic book drawer. Drawing like Marvel or DC. So I was always a bit of a comic superhero nut. But yeah, that would be, I think as time's gone on, that's the thing that I wanted more than anything. But I think when I was younger, I was kind of more of it was a flip between the Human Torch. You know, Human Torch is like the guy who can set himself on fire and fly around. Or right. Wolverine. Because I'm thinking Wolverine would be amazing, because if he can heal and adapt to an injury, imagine his training adaptation.
Yeah.
Because he's adapting to a stress, imagine how fit he would get all the time.
that's a hack worth having, isn't it?
That would be a hack. Yeah. He'd be like a super, like all that training that you do, you'd just absorb it within the blink of an eye, and then you could do it again and again and again. Imagine how much you recover from all the training you could be doing.
But the thing is that all of these superpowers, when you actually, if you extrapolate them, they all have downsides somewhere, don't they? They've got to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, Wolverine he lived forever, right? That could be a downside.
Yeah, you know? when there's none of your friends left and you're on your own.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm. Yeah. What about you? I know you said you were really busy. Do you get a chance to read, or do you listen to Audible?
Yeah, so more. I mean, I was saying to my friend the other day, the ultimate time when I know that I've got my life in check is when I'm actually having time to read. But no, more recently I've been more on the audiobooks, just because it's a lot easier. So, I mean, the last book that I read was the One Thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was my wife bought me that for Christmas, and it took me a while to get through it just because I haven't read it. And then
didn't make it the one thing, did you?
I didn't make it the one thing. No, I had too many things on to make it the one thing. but then the book that I've just literally finished was is Lifespan by David Sinclair. Have you heard of that? So he's a professor from Harvard, and it's all about basically he suggested that aging is a disease, and it's something that can be cured. rather than, it's a really good book. I definitely recommend it. Fascinating character. And it goes through a lot of the things, you know, as to why we age and all to do with DNA damage and how we can stop it from things like from pharmaceutical things to the importance, you know, all the things that you probably are already aware of, like low blood sugars, hot colds and all those sorts of things that can be great for helping with aging. So it's a great book, and he puts forward a pretty convincing argument, but there's also some real, and he finishes, because I just finished it yesterday, and he finishes with some of the threats to society. And funnily enough, he really goes on about how the world will be hit with a pandemic in the next few years, and quite timely, because obviously he knew something that no one else did at the time. So,
well,
yeah, good book.
My last book I read was one called The Seventh Sense.
Yeah, right.
And that was talking about how there are paradigm shifts and changes in the way the world operates and the way people see things. So you can think about the Industrial Revolution, where we went from sort of sail and horse-drawn power to motorized transport. And, you know, and then we got the sort of like, you know, the ability to talk to each other over the phone and that sort of thing. And it was a completely different way of thinking. And people who couldn't think in that way got left behind. But the people who could sort of straddle both at the time, both ways of thinking, were the ones who, and could see into the future and the way the world was going to be, were the ones who were successful. Now they're talking about the fact that we're so connected. But he talks about the impact of things like a pandemic. So, and this book was written in 2018 as well. So there's, you know, there are several people out there that have probably been reading some of the medical stuff that was coming out from people predicting pandemics 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I think even Bill Gates was predicting one, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. And the poor, and now everyone's around this conspiracy theory, right? That he goes,
yeah.
I mean, it's just absolutely some. Well, let's not get into that, but crazy.
Well, I tell you an interesting thing, Dan. A book that has cropped up three times in the last couple of days from three different people independently is called Atomic Habits.
Oh, okay.
Alan Cousins was talking about it. You know Alan from Boulder?
I know. He's someone who I follow a lot. He's a really, really smart guy.
Well, I had Alan and I were chatting last week on the he'll be out. He's the week before you, actually. So,
right. Okay.
He was last. Okay. So as now we're talking to people listening to it, Alan was last week. Alan recommended that. Then and it's all about compound interest and the compound interest of endurance training. How it's just, you know, the benefits, which we'll probably get onto in a minute, are just exponential. So that's one book that's on my list. But I've had some.
Is it on an audio? I'll have to look it up if it's on an audio book.
Not sure, but I've had some fantastic recommendations in the last few months, and it's crossed my mind to go through all of the show notes I've done and write down this list of books, and then I'll end up with a book of I'll end up with a list of 100 books to read, which made me think of the film The Equalizer with them. I think, is it Wesley Snipes? No.
Yeah.
Is it Wesley Snipes?
It's Wesley Snipes, yeah.
But in Equalizer 2, he goes back to the bookshop having rescued that girl from the train in Turkey. He goes back and he picks up the last book that's on his list because he's been, you know, he's an avid reader, isn't he? And he's got this 100 books to read before you die.
So
I'll make up.
I'll have to look at that one.
But, we'll put Lifespan on there.
Yeah, I've had a few. I mean, I've never met Alan in person, but we've had a few email correspondence, and he's always he's very. Does he do a lot of coaching, or seems to be more in the?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he's coaching another guest that I had on, Owen Martin, who's an Irish guy who's qualified for Kona 10 times. So you've probably bumped into Owen at some point in Kona, or swam next to him without realizing.
Maybe.
Hey, listen. I know you like living in Auckland, and you said you like listening to the Yorkshire accent. So there's two great places, but probably quite similar in terms of weather, I suppose. If you didn't live in Auckland, is there anywhere else you'd prefer to live other than coming back here?
There's definitely differences between Yorkshire and Auckland, I can tell you. The weather's slightly better here in Auckland, and I do live near the sea here. But I don't like the thing. I don't know if it was a place. I have a vision of what I would like, and I'd love to have a little, like, somewhere in the Rockies, like just my own little cabin on top of a mountain somewhere that's, You know, I think it'll be more of a getaway place that I don't know if I want to live there all the time, but I always have fancied something like that where I can just a bit somewhere that's completely off the grid, really tranquil. But I don't know how long I don't know if I'd live there. That's the thing. I think I'd just want it to be there for a short period. So, I mean, there's beautiful parts of New Zealand, like we've always talked about Wanaka and Wanaka in New Zealand is a place that's just amazing. But yeah. I have to say I'm pretty fortunate in where I am, where I live at the moment. Really, really happy.
Wanaka, is that where they did Challenge New Zealand at one point?
Challenge Wanaka. It's an amazing part of the world. It's where Braden Currie lives, actually. Yeah, I mean, amazing part. I mean, it's get very cold down there, but yeah, that's why you might want to choose the times of the year that you're there. Mm. So, yeah. But that, because I live near the sea. And the other part, I love the beach. My wife loves the sea. She loves being near the sea, especially. But the other part that I love is the mountains. So, you know, to have those two things would be awesome. So,
yeah, not many places where you can get from summit to sea in half a day. Is there skiing and surfing and skiing the same 24 hours?
It's possible in New Zealand though.
Yeah, you used to be able to do it in Seattle as well. If you can go down to see though, it's still a bit cold in Seattle, but Vancouver maybe you can get if you were in Whistler. I suppose you could get from the sea. Well, I'm not sure about swimming in the sea in Whistler, but
might be a bit chilly.
I have been to Whistler and swam there. Yeah, because we went to Ironman Canada that year that way 1 year. So we stayed in Whistler one night, had a swim there. So you could I don't know whether you could ski in the summer, but. Definitely summit to sea and sea to summit and all that. Yeah. What about on your bucket list, Dan? Apart from places you want to go, what, you know, you've been Ironman age group, Ironman world champion. You've got the record there. You're the fastest Ironman in Yorkshire. What else is left for you to accomplish, young man?
Oh, I don't know. Well, I guess there's lots I want to do in the coaching space, I guess. So I still want to try and get, I still have never got an athlete on the podium, like a pro on the podium in Kona, which I think, you know, I would love to achieve that. But in terms of my own personal things, there's still some races that I'd love to do that are on my bucket list. I'd love to do Embrun Man. I'd love to do Roth as well. They're the two things that I'd really like to do. More recently, I've actually just bought a mountain bike, so I'm trying something a bit new. And I've entered a 100-kilometer mountain bike race in Rotorua here in Auckland, the Waka 100, which is going to be a huge challenge. Because I mean, it's been amazing to see the differences in between being a good mountain bike and being a good road cyclist. Mm-hmm. It's almost two different sports. Like you have the fitness of cycling, but I've been riding with guys who are way, you know, physically weaker than me, but they can absolutely school me on a mountain bike. It's
uphill or downhill.
Yeah, either, because of the efficiency of the lines they choose, and that's something that I'm trying to knock off the bucket list at the moment. Not that it was ever really a bucket list thing, but it's something that I'm doing that's a bit new, and I'm really enjoying it actually. So.
I've got a feeling then that once you've done that, the Leadville will be on there.
What's the Leadville?
I think it's the Leadville 100. I think it's a 100-miler if it's in America. So it's up at altitude, and it's quite a famous mountain bike race. I think Lance and some of the other pros have done it quite a few times.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's really, I mean, 100K on a mountain bike is no joke.
No.
It's a long way. And in Rotorua, where this race is, it's mostly single track. Mm. So, man, it's amazing what those mountain bikes will do.
Yeah, we did a few years ago, 2012, I think it was. We did an X try. The swim was in Eastbourne. It was supposed to be an Ironman distance, although it was so rough that day. The swim was commuted to a mile, which then meant a mile and a half run along the seafront on tarmac and bare feet.
Nice.
112, yeah, so a full Ironman distance mountain bike ride across the South Downs Way through the night and in the most torrential rain ever. So that took about 15 hours, and then a 28-mile run along the Old Sarum Way from Winchester to Salisbury.
Yeah, that's hard.
That was
what was that? Speaking of crazy races, what was that old race in the Lake District? I've always wanted to do that as well.
Oh, the Jennings Lakeland, was it?
I don't know. I can't remember, but you went up some of the real steep passes in the Lake District, and then the run was basically up the side of a... I can't remember.
It might have been the Jennings Lakeland. I mean, there is a race up there now. I can't think what it's called, and somebody will no doubt write in and tell me. But it follows the Fred Whitten cycle route.
Yeah.
And then it takes you up Scarfell or something, you know.
Scarfell.
Yeah.
Is it Scarfell Pike? Is that what it's called? Scarfell Pike?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the one. I would love to have a crack at that. I do have some of the races that I did when I was younger, I'd love to, you know, come back and do some of those again, like, you know, Bala Triathlon that I used to do every year when I was younger. I don't know if that's even still running, but some of those races I'd love to have a crack at.
You can come back and see if the 40-year-old Dan can beat the 20-year-old Dan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I did. I had a few good races at the sprint distance, but they used to have a middle distance race in Ballow as well, which I never did, but I'd love to come back and do that.
It was always one of the first middle distance races of the year, about the beginning of June, so you could get it. It could be really cold and wet, or it could have a lovely day. You basically went out and all the way up. So you got a big long climb for the first 20-30K, and then it came around in a big loop, and then you came back down again. I think it was only an 80K ride. And then the run took you out along the back of the lake, and it sort of progressively went up.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you turned around, you were sort of coming back down, but it wasn't never straight down. You'd be dropping, and then all of a sudden there'd be a nasty little kicker.
Well, the Olympic distance race was... That they ran you up the side of the massive hill there as well.
Yeah.
Remember, I did it when I won it maybe two times, but I also did it the year it was the Home Nations Championships and Mark Jenkins won it. Yeah. I always remember because it was Mark Jenkins was there. There's Richard Allen was doing it. Somehow or another, I ended up first out of the water and I was first onto the bike. I'm not even sure how. And I was like, what am I doing here?
Well, I mean, I knew Rich Allen when he was when he first started, you know, coming down to Airborough Triathlon Club. So Rich was never Rich never started out with a swim background. He just he just got to where he did with hard work. He was always very powerful on the bike, and he was always a very good runner.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark was always a reasonably good swimmer, but you had an advantage there, I would have thought, on the swim. You started off from a swim background, didn't you? So,
well, yeah, my swimming sucks now, though, Simon. I can't get it anywhere near to what it used to be. I'm so, I don't know. I was saying to my friend the other day, my swimming's, I don't know, I just can't get it. I can't get it to where it used to be at all.
That's age, mate. That's age.
Yeah, shoulder mobility or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, so thanks for doing the warm up, and that always provides a nice conversation. You get an insight into somebody's life and just some different things about them that might not come out in the normal conversation. One of the other reasons I wanted to catch up with you was because you've just done some research that you've published about an HRV led training program versus a normally structured one. So I'd like to catch up and talk about that in a while. But you graciously gave me an insight into your Endure IQ education program that you're now running, and we will put some show links to that. How many you've got four courses out now, haven't you?
We've got three courses out. We'll be building the fourth one shortly. Yeah, yeah. So, the aim, how many courses we have eventually, I'm not sure, but we'll certainly have in the short term, we're going to have four. So one is on low-carb diets, and then we've got training fundamentals. And the one we've just brought out recently is training in the heat, or heat acclimation, training in the heat, preparing for the heat.
So, okay. So yeah. The one that I've been doing is LDT 102,
which
is all about the fundamentals of training. I've loved it. It's been great. I'm not going to give the game away because we want people to sign up and do it. It'd be interesting. This is my thinking here, Dan. You know, it's the middle of July now. in the world of Ironman, most people these days have to sign up a year in advance to do a race. But if you're in the UK now and you're signing up for a race in July 2021, you've probably still got 2 or 3 months of your season left. So you're not thinking about preparing for next year. Although, you know, that's one thing that I do think is remiss with a lot of people is that they have a season by season training rather than thinking about putting in place stuff for long term. However, the fact that the coronavirus situation has wiped out just about all races for this year means that most people are just treading water and keeping fit. So they have a fantastic opportunity to put a 12 months preparation in place and to make sure that there's absolutely no stone left unturned. You know, they can start the training for next year now. They don't have to start it in November, having had a month off and, you know, gained a bit of weight and lost a bit of fitness and a bit of motivation. So I thought it'd be perfect to sort of work through some of the stuff you do in LDT 1 or 2 and some of those principles you talk about and try to help people put together a plan for Ironman for next year. So, sure. the thing that I liked about this first, because, you know, another man who we both reference and who he's been on this show, and again, I put the show link to him, is Stephen Seiler. We've both got a great deal of admiration for that man, haven't we?
Yeah, he actually emailed me this morning. We're actually writing a paper together as we speak. So I've actually haven't opened it yet, but always nice to see an email coming from him for sure.
Yeah. Well, I know he's been on holiday because he was going off to somewhere in Norway.
Because
I'd asked him if he wanted to come on to do another podcast as well. I wanted to do a live show with him and get people a live audience and have people asking him some questions.
Cool.
But one of the basis for your LDT 102 is what I've referenced and what Stephen and I talked about was his hierarchy of endurance training.
Yes, for sure.
Now, I have a request here. Given that we've got so long to prepare, I wonder if we could put down a foundation to the foundation of the hierarchy.
All right. Yeah, I see it, yeah.
Okay, so repeat if you don't mind, Dan. Tell everybody what part one of the hierarchy is.
Part one of the hierarchy is the frequency and volume of training.
Right. So basically, if all you can do is train, just get as much training in at a low intensity and do that consistently. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And don't worry about intervals. Don't worry about training zones. Just train by feel. Not too easy, not too hard. Okay. For me, underpinning everything that we do as athletes are our sleep. That underpins everything, recovery, ability to function, mental acuity, the way in which your body responds to nutrition. There is mobility and strength, which allows us to build a robust body. So we briefly talked about, because there's no reference to specific strength training in here, that we'll talk about there is specific strength training, as in pushing a big gear in the bike and running uphill and using paddles, but there's no traditional strength training, as in lifting weights and building robustness. And you know, from a strength training background, I think that that's something that should be in a program. But so building a robust, resilient body to withstand injury, and basic, simple, sustainable nutrition, and the mobility, which gives us the range of movement so we can work efficiently. Okay, so would you allow me to put that in as building a basement underneath those principles to support everything over the next few months? And do you, as a coach and a scientist, do you think it's a good idea for athletes to get focused on that at the same time as they're getting going on a program? Because if you don't do it now, once training takes over, those things get left, and then you only really start to come back to them when everything unravels and you start wondering why you aren't making progress or why you're getting ill.
Yeah, well, I guess all those things that you mentioned, they're more fundamental life habits that I think are just absolutely, I mean, they're the basics to survival, right? And I think that you can even take it out of even just, we're talking about athletes now, but I think, you know, these are things that people should be doing and having in place anyway. I mean, even some of the mobility and strength stuff, you know, there's certain things that you, a requirement of physical strength and mobility that people need to just live an everyday life anyway. And I think, those things certainly need to be in place before you really progress on your on the journey of whatever you're doing. But yeah, I guess it'll be surprising as to how many people actually have that in place. You think that most people 20, 30, 40, 50 years on the world would have that sorted by now, but it's not many generally have.
Well, you and I have both been using the WHOOP, and yeah. you were saying that some of the things that you've noticed about the habits of your pro athletes have surprised you even.
Yeah, like some of you even like, so with the WHOOP app, you can measure how many hours of sleep you get. You can measure the quality of the sleep. And you know, some of my pro athletes, they'll have less sleep than some of my age group athletes who, you know, they're working and they're going to the, you know, they're holding down big jobs as well as the family. I mean, lots of my pros have family as well, but yeah, it's just such a fundamental thing that I think can't be missed, and has to be got right before you can really start progressing up that pyramid.
Hmm. I think also that the whole coronavirus situation has perhaps highlighted the importance of health and things that we might take for granted, and maybe it's caused a lot of people to reset their values in terms of what's important.
Yeah, yeah. I know from certainly my experience, you know, the corona in New Zealand, it's not been as bad as everyone else, the rest of the world, so we've been quite fortunate in that regard. But it kind of went one way or the other with a lot of people, I found. Like, people either went really crappy diet, no exercise, veg, or some people really took advantage of the situation. You know, they completely rescheduled their life, you know, eating well, more exercise, and it's I think it's been really beneficial in that regard, that people have actually some people have really taken made the most of the opportunity.
You can't see this, Dan, but actually, talking of nutrition, I got to give the chili a stir while we're chatting.
What's that?
I say you can't see that, but
you're giving the chili a stir.
The chili needs a stir while you're chatting away there.
You must have it on a slow cook.
Yeah, well, I was out this morning, but it's just simmering away. It needed a stir there. It'll be done for when we're done. So let's move on to the pyramid that you and Stephen Seiler have sort of, you know, both used and referred to. So the first thing that we need to do as athletes is just to get the frequency and volume of training in.
Mm.
Yeah. So we're not really interested in what the percentage of intervals are or how hard. It's just training below that aerobic threshold and doing lots of easy stuff and as much as we can handle it with our time constraints.
As much as you can handle, but at a low intensity. And I think you can still, like, that's not to mean to say that you don't do any high intensity. I think doing interspersing with maybe one short interval based session. So a short interval would be anything less than a minute. I think that's quite good. And the reason I say short intervals is when you look at, and you've had a prof on here who knows way more about high intensity interval training than I do. But when you look at short intervals, they're really easy to manipulate in terms of when you look at neuromuscular, anaerobic and aerobic contributions to that type of work. One of those a week, you get a good crossover of the whole thing. So yeah. I still think you should include that, but you're talking, you know, in terms of the total program, it's very, very negligible, like, you know, 2-3%. And it's amazing how much you can still improve, particularly with people who are newer to the sport and haven't really been doing it very much, how much you can improve from that. And the reason being is you consider the determinants of Ironman performance, and an Ironman is basically, it's, you're trying to push your aerobic threshold. So the aerobic threshold being, it's kind of like that point at where it becomes difficult to talk. Most people would describe it as somewhat hard. So it's not actually that high of intensity, but that the more you can push that up, you will 100% get better at Ironman triathlon, because that's pretty much where most people would do their racing. I've just had an age group. I've been coaching an age group guy based out in the States for the past two or three months now. And with him, he first started, he hadn't had any proper coaching before, quite new to the sport. And this is the approach we took with him and established what I believed was his true aerobic threshold, or some might call it the math, but I go through a, what I do is I'll actually go through a variety of steps where I'll look at heart rate drift and I'll gradually bring up the intensity to make sure that I really do home in quite nicely on that aerobic threshold heart rate. And he just basically did aerobic threshold heart rate with one short interval training session a week, which was done on the bike. And he took his FTP from 270 to 350. That's quite a big jump.
Yeah.
And that's with no high intensity work hardly at all, just pretty much all aerobic work.
Have you ever come across Ali Hollington? I'm pretty sure.
I know Ali Hollington
married to Ken McLaren.
Yeah, she used to be a duathlete she used to go head to head with Helen Cawthorne back in the day, Mick English's partner. Remember?
Yeah, I do. And I'm fairly certain that Ali had a heart issue that sort of stopped her doing high intensity training, but she still gets to Kona most times she tries because she's got this huge engine so she can keep going all day. Very efficient.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you're saying there really is, and there's lots of people who are now talking this same story. So, you know, Brad Kearns and the guys at Prime Endurance are also doing this, Andrew McNaughton, and they basically say just train easy, train steady below that aerobic threshold. Don't exhaust yourself, and then when you feel like it, absolutely smash it, and you just add a little bit onto your fitness. And if you keep doing that, you'll always keep moving forward. The big problem for a lot of age group athletes is because they try to do too much, they get injured, and then it's like playing sort of a game of triathlon snakes and ladders, that you make progress then you slip back, and you make progress and you slip back. And the key is to maintain the consistency. And if you're always hammering yourself, eventually you're going to come unstuck.
Yeah, I mean, consistency is absolutely everything. And I think, you know, as coaches as well, we're guilty of it ourselves. I mean, I find myself in that same position when I'm writing programs and working with athletes, is that I almost feel bad for just saying 50-minute run at a low heart rate or three-hour ride at a low heart rate, because I feel like it's a cop-out, because I'm not giving, you know, I'm not giving them something that's really elaborate and well thought out and intervals at this. And it makes me feel like I'm doing them a disservice. But you know, it's not that way. It's what's best, and it can be quite boring for an athlete, and it can be quite, you know, if you feel bad as a coach. But the gains are massive, and at the end of the day, you're here to train, you know, train, not be entertained, so to speak. So it's I mean, that is quite a hard thing. But there is also a people have to be aware that there's also a stagnation. That training will take people so far. So with my pros, for example, I wouldn't really do that very much, because they need more than that. They need more stimulation. You need to kind of progress in more of a methodical manner, with knowing the end target and building sessions towards that. Because there's only doing just low intensity endurance work will only get them so far. And even with my age group athletes, I'll do consistent tests where we'll hold the heart rate at a specific level, like that, just like the math test. You hold the heart rate, you look at the power, you look at the pace, and you track that over time. And the moment that kind of stagnates, and Phil Mathetone actually taught me this himself, is that, you know, if you're doing that quite regularly and you see that doesn't really progress two times in a test, then that's probably the point where you say, okay, I'm going to need to change the stimulus. I'm going to need to have to add a little bit of more stress to my training, whether that might mean you're adding some strength work, you're adding a bit more high intensity work, you're adding some tempo work, whatever that might be. You can measure and manage the point of where you decide to do that. Because if you're still improving with that, you're still making great gains.
Mm. Yeah. So there's a couple of things there, Dan. You talked about testing. When you do the testing the aerobic threshold, and you're looking at the heart rate versus the pace, and you're talking about decoupling. So once the heart rate starts to drift up and the pace, you know, for the same pace, or the heart rate stays the same but the pace drops, when and where are you doing those tests? Are they lab tests, or are you doing them out in the field?
No, I just do them at home on the trainer, on a treadmill, or on your bike in the indoors. You know, as long as you make sure reasonably same conditions, it's totally fine. You definitely don't need lab testing to do that.
So my question, my question about all of that is doing it indoors, is that does core temperature not have an impact on heart rate then? Because indoors, you're going to get much hotter than if you're outdoors, aren't you, generally, because there's less cooling.
Yeah, there is. But I mean, as long as you're comparing apples with apples, I mean, you're using it as a way to progress from one to the other. So as long as you're not doing it one time outdoors, one time indoors, I mean, obviously there's slight differences in temperature indoors, but if you've, it's not, it wouldn't get too dissimilar as long as you have a fan and whatnot. It wouldn't be too, to make too much difference.
And how long, you know, how long a session would you need to do to be able to demonstrate a drift in heart rate?
I think an hour on the bike and about an 8K run is usually what I do with my, my athletes. Yeah.
Okay. So heat's not going to play too big a part in an hour session then, but if it was longer, it probably would do.
Yeah. And also you want it to be reasonably, you don't have it to be too long, because there's always going to be a point where you will start getting a heart rate drift. And this is to do with the, what I would determine as a more of a durability index. And that's why, so if you think about what happens in an Ironman, you can, if you look at someone who's done a well-paced Ironman run, they'll have a nice flat. So say they're running 4-minute Ks, 4-minute Ks, 4-minute Ks. Heart rate will be very stable. And then suddenly pace stays the same. Nothing changes. But then heart rate will start to drift up. And the reason being is because what you see in the VO2, like something called VO2 slow component and heart rate drift, they all pretty much will always start occurring after the aerobic threshold. And how steep that drift is dependent on whether that exercise is severe. So really, really heavy exercise, it's really, really steep. But when it's just over the aerobic threshold, you get a very slight rise. But what happens over time, and what is most likely happening in an Ironman, is that as you get more tired, your threshold is actually dropping. So suddenly 4-minute Ks is aerobic threshold, but then as you get more tired, it's actually now becoming like 4:10s, and you're a little bit over, and then you start getting a drift in the heart rate. So
my argument, going back to the strength training, is this is where that sort of starts to tell, is your posture stops, your strength around your calf muscles and your foot muscles weaken, so your foot strike isn't as efficient, your glutes stop functioning as effectively, your core starts to weaken, so each step is costing you more energy. And
yeah, there's a bit of that for sure, but I think the main things that are happening is more of the stretch shortening cycle and tendon elasticity and tendon stiffness. That's the main thing that's slowing people down towards the back end, which is, that's where I think plyometrics and stuff like that could play a massive role in the back end of an Ironman. Because there are some things where you are having losses in core and some of your glutes, but the main thing is, basically, you're losing stride length. The main reason you're using stride length is the springiness of your step. I mean, you'll see that's why people get that, you know, pretty much no vertical flight at the back end of a marathon, right? So,
but if you watch the good runners like Crowe and Rinny, they've still got that right at the back end, haven't they?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You, Dan, I've watched the last few K of you running it in Kona there, and your form was still pretty good there.
Yeah, it was, yeah, but didn't really do any strength training.
Yeah.
But I know that Craig Alexander is a big proponent of strength training, so yeah.
So coming back to your favorite motto about context and content.
Yeah.
I
think there's a lot to be said for where, you know, like that's where I think the, you know, specific strength comes in. You know, I do consider myself to be quite a strong athlete. And I think it's because I grew up in, you know, such a hilly area. And I would say Alistair's probably similar, you know, someone like him. Mm-hmm. I grew up on a one in four hill that was a mile long, super hilly. And yeah, I think that actually has a massive benefit.
Well, I remember just, do you know Jamie Pringle? Do you remember Jamie?
Yeah, Jamie Pringle, he's a physiologist at EIS, right?
He was. Then he went to the Boardman Performance Center.
Right, okay.
Not sure what he's doing now, that's closed down. But Jamie showed me around the EIS lab there, And he was showing me this machine that they were using for eccentric training, which was all about creating tendon stiffness and sort of stiffness under the eccentric loading. And we talked about whether one of the reasons why Alistair was such a good runner was because of that stiffness that they had, that him and Johnny had around the sort of lower limb joints that was developed from all of that downhill running as well. Which is actually, downhill running is a component that's often ignored, but there's an awful lot of tendon stiffness and eccentric strength to be gained out of that. And I think that's something that a lot of people could...
For sure. And if you in LDT 101, remember I talk around doing that hilly tempo run. And the aim of that hilly tempo run, and I say it's really a massive key session. It's always been a big key session for my athletes and a key session for what I've done in the past. And with the aim of that tempo run is you're actually trying to keep heart rate stable. Yeah. So it's really a really undulating run, but say you're trying to keep heart rate at like 150, so which is maybe around your Ironman heart rate. It means that up the hills, you're actually trying to hold back, but then down the hills, you have to really absolutely hammer it. And I think that's really that's a great session to build some good tendon stiffness and some good eccentric load.
Now, quite interestingly, most Ironman courses are pretty flat. A lot of people don't realize that Kona is quite undulating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, for sure.
So did you find that tempo run that you did in the build-up to Kona really played dividends? Because, you know, you're running down into the energy lab, but then you've got to turn around and run back up. Then once you come out of the energy lab, you're running downhill back to the harbour before you start the uphill climb back into town. Yeah. It's a little bit lumpy on the way. On the way out and back on a Leahy Drive as well, isn't it? It's not flat like most people think.
It's definitely not a flat course, and you can see that from the K-splits because they're quite up and down. But yeah, I mean, who knows whether? Yeah, I mean, I think it's impossible to say which one session, or you know, cause it's never one session that made. I think it definitely made a difference. But I've always included this same session in every single build to an Ironman I've ever done. And it's quite remarkable because I think as a predictor for me, it's just this one course that I do. It's around a park in Auckland. And I can really quite easily predict how fast I will run a marathon based on how my heart rate and speed around this course. So but if I, it's a really hilly course. And what I find is that whatever my average pace is, it's 10 miles long. Whatever my average pace is for this 10 mile course, if my heart rate is around what I would do in an Ironman, the average, if I just extrapolate the average kilometers, that's generally the pace that I'll run in the Ironman as well. So
what I seem to be picking up from this, Dan, is despite the fact that you're a physiologist and you spend a lot of time in the lab, for the majority of people, they could get by without coming into your lab and have a certain number of benchmark sessions that they do. At home, indoors or out, you know, I know in LDT 102, you talk about some benchmark swim sets. There's definitely some benchmark bike sets. And what you're talking about there is just having a run that you do regularly that's, you know, at home that you can use to compare fitness. You know, if you compare that with your race performances, use it as a predictor as well.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think you definitely do not need a lab to monitor your progression. In fact, some ways they're worse, I believe, for in terms of a monitoring perspective, they're worse. It depends on what you're trying to achieve. If you're looking at something like you want to improve your fat oxidation, then of course it's really hard to do that without getting into the lab, or you want to know what your accurate training zones are, because like just doing an FTP test and guessing what a percentage is of that, you know, it's not that accurate. So there's certain things where a lab's really beneficial. But from a day-to-day training progression standpoint, it's really, really good. Really, really good. And, you know, I've worked in so many different sports, Simon, you know, like rowing and kayak, and we take the same approach in every single sport I've ever done, is that you always have what I would call key sessions that seem to give you the best determinant of success in that sport. So for like rowing, I had a session that was, it was 4 1Ks, best pace with 3 minutes recovery. And if a rower could get close to maybe 100% of world record time, even over 98% of their world record time for all four as an average, that person, I could almost with 99% certainty guarantee that they would win the world championships. You know, it's kind of getting those kind of ideas of what it means for you and what it, and if you're a coach, what it means for your athletes. And with Ironman, it's quite a, it's a bit of a different thing because it's not necessarily a speed thing. So with rowing, like, you know, you do your best pace and that's, you know, your rowing is 2K. It's pretty high intensity and it's best pace. Whereas at Ironman, it's a different thing. It's really about doing things easier. It's about how easily you can do something because everyone's more than capable of running the pace required to do a 240 marathon. Well, most people are, but the problem is they can't do it easy enough. So there's different ways that then monitoring becomes more important because things like heart rate is absolutely key. I mean, a main thing for me is I will often do with my athletes 8K run off the bike on the treadmill. And I'm just really interested to see what the heart rate is and how that's changing over time. So before I did Kona, I did a 2 hour run and then I did a 10K off. I did a 10K at the end of the 2 hour run on the treadmill and I ran 38 and a half. So my average heart rate was 135. So, you know, that to me is a sure sign that you're in good shape when your heart rate's not really going high and the pace is reasonable. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing that you can use.
So just a couple of things on this, frequency and volume. Seems to me there then, a rising tide lifts all boats. Doing all of that low level training is pushing those levels of performance up from underneath. We're not doing the, we are going to do some intervals to pull things up, but not as much as most people would think. Well, what we're doing is just getting a huge big volume in and filling the bath up and lifting everything up.
Yeah, exactly. You're just building the, baking the cake, so to speak.
Steven Seiler.
Yeah, exactly. Bake the cake before you eat the cake.
And it takes a lot longer to bake a good cake than it does to eat it, that's for sure. As all good Yorkshiremen know, it doesn't take long to eat a cake.
Yeah, for sure. But if we just continuing on that same theme, and like, you know, from a what's happening from a physiological perspective, and we talk about mitochondria and the powerhouse of the muscle cell, so where basically energy is made, aerobic energy is made. The belief and the thoughts, and this is specifically coming out of a lab in Australia where Professor David Bishop's the lead man there, and the idea that the volume, the easy low intensity volume, is increasing mitochondrial content. So you're the number of engines you've got in your muscles, which is obviously very, very important, because if you don't have a lot of those, polishing those engines isn't really going to do you much good.
So I mean, this is the essence of the polarized training model we're talking about here, isn't it, really? The 90% of this sort of like lowish intensity, high volume, and then polishing those mitochondria. And again, at certain times, if you keep going through that throughout the year, I guess you do get a bit stagnant, so you'd have to break it up with, okay, a bit more threshold type work and some higher intensity for a little bit to sort of lift everything up again, and then go back to this at different times of the year. And I guess that's where you, if you were in what I can't remember what you term it as, a sort of like that, is it structured periodization or block periodization, where you're training for short blocks of training for races, you would do that, wouldn't you? You'd do 2 or 3 months of this low volume, low intensity, high volume, and then you would add some intensity on to prepare for a race, and then you go back to the low volume coming out of the race, and then you build again.
And the block, you know, the block periodization, it's come back into fruition recently in a lot of sports science, but you know, traditional block periodization was blocks over long periods of time where people would almost do an entire winter phase of just doing endurance training. And I believe that not to be, to just focus on that one thing for a long time, I think it can set you back a little bit, because it takes so long then to get the speed back, and you almost lose 3 weeks before you can actually train properly again. But more traditionally, that typical block periodization, and it comes out of, I don't even heard of an author called Ronald Stad, done a lot in this area, is a same Scandinavian area as Steven Seiler, but yeah, he's done some things where he just looks at one week of block periodization, where you do like pretty much like 30 hours of endurance, pure endurance training, and then like 15 hours of just back-to-back high-intensity interval training, like day in, day out, and then a bit of a recovery period. And shown huge improvements in VO2 max specifically from doing those shorter block periodizations. And I think that's a really good thing to consider as well. Like, yeah, I've actually been trying that a bit with some of my pro athletes, and they seem to get some real good gains out of doing it. So you almost like you do, so even if it was coming up to racing, you could do a real big endurance block for a week, working in 3 week cycles, a real big endurance block, then a high intensity block, and then more of a race specific block. And then, yeah, then an easy race, and then you can just keep cycling that round. So
good way to get somebody in shape very quickly then if you needed to.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what it showed. It showed massive improvements in VO2 max over very short periods of time.
But I suppose ultimately, quick like most things, get rich quick schemes, they don't last very long. So it's having that fundamental base that we've talked about from the high volume, low intensity training that allows you to sustain this fitness over long periods of time, which is what we're really looking for.
Is that, yeah, for sure. And it goes back to baking the cake, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so you can make a cake quickly, but...
Yeah, but it's not going to be of high quality.
No. So yeah. One of the things that I really learned, and you talked about mitochondria then, I knew about how important mitochondria were. So that bit about the volume builds the quantity, and the intensity polishes up what we've got for race day. But something else you talked about was about signaling and about the value of doing double training sessions, so training twice in a day, because there's something about the signaling to those cells that if you sort of reinvigorate them a bit later on in the day, you get a much better response than if you just leave them to rest.
Yeah, and that comes out of some work by Keith Barr, and he wrote a review on this, and basically he's showing the time course of the signal for adaptation or change post exercise, and I think that's something that you can really bring into any training program because it makes a lot of sense. His basic idea was it takes around 7 to 8 hours for a signal to pretty much go back to baseline levels. So if you consider what that means, if you're getting good frequency in your training, you're doing morning and afternoon sessions, and you're doing it quite regularly, you're actually continuously pushing the adaptation response, you're pushing yourself to have to adapt to the training that you're doing. So rather than so the worst thing you could possibly do would be like an absolutely massive session on the Monday, then not do anything again until the Wednesday. You'd be better off splitting that session up over the course of those two extra days, and you'd probably would likely get better training or better adaptation from that.
So here's a question for you, Dan. You and I probably know a lot of people who commute to work, and they think that they've got a half hour ride or a half hour run into work and then a half hour run home. And they almost discount that as training because, it's not particularly good quality, but yet they're getting those 2 half-hour sessions in. Is there some value to that in terms of the signaling you just talked about than just doing an hour's run in the morning?
Yeah, there's definitely some value to that. Like, because, 30 minutes is still 30 minutes. I mean, if you're doing like, if it's like 10, 5 minutes, then okay. Maybe that's not, I mean, who know? I mean, I've been asked the question of how little is too little, and I'm not really sure. And I'll just take a guess. I would say anything less than 10 minutes is probably, it's probably not really worth it, but there's definitely, the signal will be strong, right? So especially if you're giving it a little bit of welly, and you're not just like, on your e-bike and got it on full charge, So, I mean, when I lived in Singapore, I used to cycle to work every day, and that was the exact same thing, yeah. 20 to 30 minutes. And I had some of my best cycling shape when I was living there and I think that was a big reason was because I was doing those daily commutes.
Yeah, I guess you didn't want to cycle too hard, though. I remember you telling me just how hard it was to acclimatise to the humidity there. You'd never have stopped sweating if you'd ridden in too hard, would you?
Yeah, in the early days, yeah. And also the traffic was pretty bad as well. I used to go straight down the centre of Orchard Road to get to work. It's pretty, taking life into your own hands, so to speak, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, I was a bike courier in Perth when I was in my early 20s. I did a few months out there, and learning to ride in traffic. I never fear riding in traffic now, just because you get used to how traffic flows and things. And
I would be the same from riding in Singapore too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just on this polarized training, I hear a lot of people saying, well, it's all very well for full-time athletes and, you know, those who've got, you know, 20 to 30 hours, but I've only got 10 hours a week. And so therefore, because I've got such limited time, I need to smash it all the time. What would you say to those people?
But you have to look at the specific adaptations that are occurring. Like I always tell my athletes this, is that you have to go into each session with knowing what you're trying to achieve from that session. So for example, like if you've got a VO2 max session, a VO2 max specific session, and it's 5 by 3 minutes, and you don't do that session correctly, and you go out and you do that first 3 minutes, and it's a completely anaerobic, way too hard, what you'll find is that the rest of those other four sets, heart rate you'll have very limited VO2 max, very limited time at a VO2 max heart rate, because you've gone so anaerobic at the start. And then you've almost wasted the other four intervals. So you've actually completely changed the session to being more of a lactate tolerance sort of session. So as a coach, you'd go, well, you've ruined the session. You've done completely the wrong thing. And it's the same when it comes to this, is that when training at a low intensity, you're up regular, you know, we know that up until level two, like that aerobic threshold, that's where you're training. You know, that's when your fat oxidation's most rife. That's when you're getting good turnover you're not really producing any lactate. There's loads of quality endurance aerobic adaptations. And also you're not getting too much sympathetic, you're not getting hardly any sympathetic stress. So you're actually training that specific area. Mm. And that's what's really, really important, is that you target those specific points when they're needed. Otherwise you just end up doing the same thing all the time and you'll get the same result.
So you mentioned sympathetic stress there. That's the fight or flight system, isn't it? So if we're training too hard, we're creating too much cortisol, we're putting ourselves into sympathetic stress, that takes a lot longer to recover from, which means that the sessions that you're doing either later on that day or in the sort of 24 hours following are probably going to be a little bit compromised as well if you want to go hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Steve, just to finish off there, Stephen Seiler talked about this. It's like spending a little bit too much of your budget, but eventually it doesn't feel like too bad if you overspend your budget one day. But if you keep doing a little bit too much, eventually you realize that you're overdrawn quite heavily, and that's when you start to get ill, and that's when you're going to end up backsliding on your fitness.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I always say it's like you're borrowing from Pete to pay Steve, sort of thing. It's the same. It's the same sort of mentality, is that you're just borrowing from one session to pay it back on another. And the gains. And I always, when I was working at rowing, I'd always tell the athletes this, is that the difference between going at, say, top end of your level two to the middle part of your level three. So you're going from your aerobic threshold to somewhere between your aerobic and your anaerobic threshold, training in that area. You know, there's really no gain in the training adaptation or the training benefit you're going to get in that specific sense. But the difference between going from 110 to 115% of your FTP during a short intensity interval session, because you're a little bit fresher, likely much better adaptation, because of the exponential relationship with physiological strain. Mm. Is that, you know, for the difference, if you're say your threshold power's 360 watts, going from 230 to 260 is not much difference in terms of the physiological strain, because it's on the flatter part of the curve. Mm. But going from 390 to 400 is a big difference.
So we've going to move through some of the other modules here at Dan. We've talked about training intensity distribution. We don't do a lot of that sort of stuff in between the two thresholds. A thing that's always intrigued me is this notion of the sweet spot, which when you see where it's drawn, it's between the two thresholds. And from the name, one would one would sort of assume that that's a place where we ought to spend a fair amount of time. But when I talk to people like yourself and Sila and the prof, in polarized training, we're either going below the aerobic threshold, which is one end of the sweet spot, or we're going above the anaerobic threshold, so above 90%, which means we don't spend a great deal of time in sweet spot. So why did they call it the sweet spot if we don't actually want people to go there?
On the social media, everyone always saying, what about sweet spot training? And you know, it's kind of, but I mean, it's just a funny term that's been given to training between the two thresholds, really. And the reason, I think the reason it's become, has now got this name is because it's probably the intensity that feels the best. Mm. You know, like you go above your anaerobic threshold, that doesn't feel too great. It's actually really, really hard. But then when you're doing it below your aerobic threshold, you're like, oh, this is a bit easy, you know. And but then somewhere in between, it's not really that hard. You're still getting a good lick on, so you kind of feel really good about it. I think that's where people enjoy it. And that's where, you know, it's a black hole that a lot of athletes kind of fall into. It's because it's that ultimate, it's a bit, I liken it to the ultimate like sweet and salty combo. You know, you can't resist a bit of a sweet and salty popcorn, right? Because it's just the perfect combination, and sweet spot's the perfect combination of not too hard, but I'm still kind of showing everyone how fast I am, right?
If you do too much of the sweet spot stuff, as they always say, it's kind of not easy and it's kind of not hard, and you get kind of fit, but you never really get as fit as you could do if you were doing the way that actually the people in the know who've done the research and spend the time in the lab and spend the time applying it to the athletes are saying, you don't want to do that kind of hard stuff too often. You want to do either very easy or very hard. But the athletes who think they know better seem to want to do kind of hard.
Yeah.
Okay.
As you know, there's a lot of coaches in the world, Simon.
Yeah.
Everyone's a coach.
Well, there's a lot of coaches that are still prescribing kind of hard and go hard all the time as well, or go home.
I'll just finish on, before we move on from that though, I think, you know, there's, and I've written about this in a few blogs, and you can probably find those. There's actually on the old Plues and Prof, on the Plues and Prof website still going, and there's a blog that I have on there about from polarized to pyramidal. So I think it's worth talking about pyramidal training intensity distribution. So that's kind of like when you are getting a little bit more training in that mid zone, but it's still most of your training, you're talking now like 60 to 70% is at a low intensity below the aerobic threshold, but you're just bumping up the mid zone stuff to around maybe 30% or 20 to 30%. And I think for endurance athletes, long distance triathletes, like half Ironman, Ironman athletes, that's something that we do need to consider, because that's typically where our race lies, especially 70.3. It's actually pretty much bang in the middle of those two zones. So there is some time as you get closer to competition, you might start off more polarized, but you would move more towards a pyramidal kind.
And I get that, and I totally agree with you there that there is a specific time when you'd want to do that, in the sort of maybe, you know, 6, 8, 10 weeks depending on the person, you know, and how they respond, 6, 8, 10 weeks out from racing. But for the rest of the year, you know, living where I do in Yorkshire, I wouldn't actually be planning any zone training. But to be honest, most people, when they're riding around places where we used to ride, are going to end up in there by accident, because they're going to have to be in that. That's the zone that they need to do to get up a hill.
They're not going
to be going at VO2 max very often, unless they've got one of those, that one in four that you used to live up. When they're going downhill, they've got the perfect polarized training. But if you're going up Crag Vale or something, you're going to be in that mid zone. So it's a 20, 30 minute climb, and you're going to be at somewhere between sub threshold or aerobic threshold threshold. But that's just by accident because of the route you chose. It's not that you're going on the indoor trainer or the treadmill to specifically
do that. I do think, like, you know, I don't think you have to be a complete like training intensity distribution like policeman.
Yeah.
You know, if you're living in a really hilly area, I say my athletes, you know, if your heart rate drifts a little bit over your aerobic threshold up the hills, that's fine. You know, but you just don't want it to be drifting so it's getting above like especially above VT2, but especially above that anaerobic threshold. Because, and the reason being is because those aerobic sessions, they're designed to improve endurance, they're designed to improve fat metabolism. And if you go too hard too soon or too hard at a specific time, it completely changes the outcome of that session, because the moment you have lactate production and your body has a lot of lactate present, so you go over your anaerobic threshold, suddenly there's a lot more lactate, fat metabolism shut down immediately. So then you're just, you know, you go out and you ride, you do 20 minutes in, you have a sprint up a climb with your mate, the rest of the ride you're not actually achieving what you wanted to achieve anymore.
So on that one, because it's not like turning the light switch on and off, is it, that you go from lactate production back to fat metabolism?
No, you don't.
Once you turn the fire on, the fire's got to cool down. So it takes 20 to 30 minutes before it gets to cool again. So as you say, you're not really going back into that fat production fat oxidation mode.
Exactly.
I think that, you know, for me, the thing about intensity when you're climbing or when you're running is it's, and I agree, you don't need to be absolutely controlled by it, and if I go above this, it's like I'm going to get vaporized by the Daleks. I liken those zones to being like the speed limit on the motorway. You need to know what the speed limit is and what your speed is so that you're not doing 90 miles an hour. But if you're going along the motorway doing 72 miles an hour and you're aware of it, then you're slightly above the limit, but you're okay. But if you're just speeding along at 100 miles an hour, blissfully unaware with your foot down, the next thing you know, there's going to be the police are going to be there. So it's about
It's a really good way to think about it.
About being mindful of exactly where you are and what your intensity is while you're doing it. And if you are going up a long climb, it's trying to, rather than trying to push on, it's to climb as easily as possible so you don't get too far above that fat oxidation zone.
I like the speed limit thinking. I'm like, that's quite good, because everyone pushes the speed limit as much as they can, but no one wants to push it too much, right?
Yeah, exactly. No doubt I'll be seeing that in LDT 105.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a couple more things, because I know you've got to get on with your day and do some daddy daycare. We talked about strength training and the sort of stuff that most people would be familiar with that I talk about is the traditional. Specific strength training, you have a progression there. So in the winter, you're talking about just running and riding on the hills, like we've just discussed, you know, and just include that, you know, maybe allow yourself to push a bigger gear. But then once we get into that mid-season, that sort of competition, the sort of specific conditioning phase, and then we get into the competition phase, we're going to do some very specific stuff. You might have to resort to the trainer if you haven't got any long hills. You've got some nice little nuanced sessions. I like the hill running one at Ironman pace, but of course the gradient makes it a threshold intensity. That's a nasty little one.
Yeah. You got to pick your route pretty carefully.
You have, yeah. Or use a treadmill.
Yeah. You see, I've got one right here.
I do.
I ran a marathon on that the other week.
Yeah. Takes some doing, Dan. That does. Mind you, a marathon for you is a lot shorter time than it is a marathon for me. So we need to, and I particularly like what you mentioned earlier about, rather than having a complete change from one emphasis, like all long, slow, steady stuff, to some strength stuff, to some speed stuff, because the dramatic changes, as we know from physio data, causes visits to the physio room and interruptions to your training. So a little bit of everything throughout the year, and then just change the emphasis of that depending on how close or how far you want from a race. Yeah.
Exactly. Because, I mean, with the strength stuff specifically, if you're just doing hills, you're targeting, you know, I think you should never avoid running hills. Like, I think they're always of benefit. Unless you're doing, like, for long, easy aerobic stuff, I think you always head for the hills. Unless the only reason you would try and hit the flats is if you're doing some real specific work, you know, when you're trying to hit a pace.
Yeah.
Because it just, it allows more muscle recruitment, and it allows that easier progression to when you do the short strength work and the longer strength work.
Yeah. I'd probably throw a caveat in there that the physios would say, if you've got Achilles problems, you need to be a bit more careful, but if you haven't, then definitely do that. And, you know, I often think, look at the way I went to watch, a racehorse trainer, Racehorses. They do two, 30 second sprints every day. That's all they do, but they're always slightly uphill. So they yeah, gallop right, them yeah. uphill. Yeah. And because horses are pack animals, they're always racing to try and get, you know, getting a nose in front. They're always sort of half nosing, if you like.
Yeah.
Horses.
Yeah.
But that's their strength training and their speed work uphill. And then they walk them back. Yeah. And training horse, racing horses is the perfect example of polarized training for me. When they're walking them, they spend a lot of time walking on the hills to build that basic strength. And they have them grazing on the hill as well, because it builds strength in the tendons and ligaments.
All right, that's interesting. There's a lot of the sports science that we know, like even cold water immersion, for example, was done first in horses.
Yeah.
Lots of the sports science that we know today was done, were like secondary to the horses.
You'd find that very interesting, Dan, to go and make a connection with a horse racing trainer and go and see how they look after the horses, because you'd see a lot of similarities. Yeah. I went to Mark Johnson in Middleham. He's the top flat racing trainer years running. Really interesting, all the stuff they've got, the water walkers that they've got. He used to walk he's at Middleham, up in the Dales there near Leyburn.
Right, okay.
He used to walk his horses up onto the gallops that were on the old gallops on the moors. And the other trainers thought he was mad. And he said they used to take them up in the horse boxes. And he said they just walk up and down. And once his horses started winning, everybody thought he was a genius then. But all he was doing was giving them some very low-level conditioning work and the strength every day.
Yeah. Incredible, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk. We've got strength, some very specific strength, then low RPMs on the bike, big gears. Again, we're not going to give the too many goodies away, Dan, because we want.
No, you have too much away. Exactly, yeah.
But then you've got some nice race-specific simulations, and I think this is important to be doing this for people before they come into racing. It's some very specific sets that they need to do to tune them up for races. Yeah,
and I think with the race-specific simulations, I think, you know, we talked about Gordon Walker at the start of this, and you know, he's probably the one person. He is the person who taught me about these sorts of training sessions. And the thing about those sorts of things, it comes back to those, what we talked about before, with having sessions what you can use to really get an idea of how you're going and to monitor yourself. Mm-hmm. And having those in place, it means it gives you more grounding for the rest of the program. Because if you know you want to do 4x40 minutes at 270 watts without your heart rate going over your aerobic threshold, it provides a basis for where you can start to build your program towards, because, you know, you're not just going to do that straight out the bat, right? But you know that's kind of what you'd like to achieve by the time you get to racing. You can say, okay, if I need to do this session, what other parts of the puzzle do I need to be able to pull in together to make that session a reality?
Yeah, you. One of the things you emphasize, which is something that I'm fond of doing as well, and I've done for a long time, is to work backwards. So what do we want to achieve on race day? So if we want to hold 300 watts on race day, you know, and that's 75% of my FTP, then I need to get an FTP up to this. So what sessions do I need to get my FTP up to that? So what am I going to have to progressively work to build my FTP up to that, so that then 75% of that means I can race at this on race day? So I like the fact that you work backwards, Dan. So if you are going to ride at 75% of your FTP on race day, and that is, what would that be? That would be 200 and let's say it's 225 watts. You'd need to have an FTP of 300. So what we need to do building up to the race is do sessions that are going to build our FTP up to 300. And then we also need to do some sessions where we're doing those 4x40 minutes holding 225 and make sure that we are actually able to hold that power.
Yeah. And that's where those race specific simulation sessions come in so handy, is that, you know, it just forms a great basis. And you can even take it up again. You can, you know, what if that's going to be your threshold, then what would you consider your VO2 max type sessions to be at as well? What would you need to do those at? And you can, that's the beauty of training, and what I really love about pulling together the pieces of the puzzle is you can manipulate sessions with the recovery and work ratios to make sure that you can actually at least do that power. And as you progress, you just manipulate those sessions to make them a little bit harder, reduce the recovery of the between reps, for example, or increase the duration of the rep. To just get you closer and closer to the target that you've built from the start.
Dan, right at the beginning, we talked about what a fantastic opportunity this was for triathletes who are planning on doing Ironman and 70.3 in 2021. They've got 12 months to prepare now. So if you were going to, if somebody was going to come to you and wanted to put together a program, what were the sort of four or five things that you would say to them they need to be thinking about and working on right now in order to get themselves in great shape for July 21?
Well, I think being the first things like what we talked about is making sure that you have your kind of your life in balance, of course, you know, the basic things of sleep and nutrition. And then I think, you know, the best laid plan of mice and men, so to speak, is that you have to then just build, and the first step would be to look at the overall calendar and build a plan that's where you've actually, you're kind of reversing it a little bit, where you're really trying to get a good idea of what that athlete needs to do to achieve what they want to achieve come race day, and then build it back from there. Really, that's the, and that's starting with the same principles that you're building it back. So you are actually ending up with, you're working on the most important things now, which would be, you know, frequency and volume of training, making sure that's all in place. And then having that progressive roadmap towards the inevitable goal of race-specific simulations during that more of that competition phase, where you really know what those sessions look like.
Yeah, in the lead up to 2012, Ali and Johnny Brownlee were talking about how consistent they were, you know, over several years, really, not really missing many sessions. And for a lot of athletes, I would say that's, we talked about that already, the consistency of training. What's going to get in your way of consistency? Going too hard when you shouldn't be. Something Stephen Sealer talks about, you know, intensity discipline is really important, and get those lifestyle habits, which are often the reasons why people don't get that consistency.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it always comes back to sound like a broken record, but consistency is absolutely everything. Mm. Even that, you know, 2018 when I did well in Kona, I actually started on that goal in 2015 when I crossed the line in Kona about, you know, a few moments later. I was thinking, geez, you know, I reckon I could have a crack at taking or winning the age group here. You know, and that was a 3-year thing. It wasn't just a simple one split decision and I was going to do it in one go. But like, that was 3 years of consistent training, you know, good nutrition, regular physio, regular treatment, you know, getting a good team around you to make sure you can do all the things that you need to do. And you know, half the battle is just keeping motivated and keeping going. And motivation is something that I've never, ever struggled with personally, but with some of the athletes that I work with, you know, one of the main things I really focus on is keeping them injury-free and motivated, because once you've, if you can tick those two boxes, you're 99% of the way there, you really are.
Never ceases to amaze me, Dan, when I talk to people like yourself, the Prof, Maffetone, Stephen Seiler, Alan Cousins. You know, I've not spoke to David Bishop, but I know you speak very highly of him. Jamie Pringle. You guys have got so much knowledge about physiology and about athlete performance at the highest level, and yet you all seem to come back to some simple messages. One of them is keeping things simple. Two is about putting the right foundations in. Three is about consistency, you know, simple doesn't mean easy, and difficult and complex doesn't mean it's going to be any better.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, mate. Well, it's been fantastic to catch up.
No, cool. I enjoyed it.
Thanks very much for letting me in on LDT 102. We've talked a lot about it. So can you tell the listeners where they can go to get sight of this and have a look at it and have a go if they're interested?
Yeah, for sure. So like we said, we've got three different courses. I have LDT 101, which is all around low carbohydrate performance. Did you do that one or did you not? I thought I gave you the rights.
You have, I think. You've given me access to them, but you gave me the 102 first. So I'm doing that one now.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, so there's that one. There's the 102, which is all around training. And then there's also the one around preparing for the heat. So as soon as Kona's on the cards, that's definitely one that I would consider everyone is a must do, because it's really, really important. But yeah, that all can be found on EndureIQ.com. We also have
our Instagram, EndureIQ, and my own personal Instagram at the Plues. And yeah, and then if you just follow us all on there, you'll be sure to be kept up to date with everything that's going on in the world of EndureIQ, because lots of exciting things now, and we have a few more exciting things in the future, I hope.
Well, we never did talk about HRV and the HRV-led structured versus structured training plan. So I guess that means we'll have to resume for another podcast
exactly. in a couple of months. There's too much here. We'll have to book out a whole day one time. Next time I come to Yorkshire to see my mum and dad, I'll just drive over to yours and we'll just put on a coffee and record about a few hours of content.
Although your Prime Minister's not letting any foreigners in for a bit, so I was going to say maybe I'll just pop on the plane and come to Auckland, but that'll have to be 21, won't it?
Yeah, a short hop, skip and a jump.
Oh, well, listen, Dan, Dr. Dan Plew, it's been fantastic as always to catch up with you. Thanks so much for more of your wit and wisdom regarding physiology and training. Good luck and stay safe and healthy over there in New Zealand.
Yeah, you too. And thanks to everyone for tuning in and listening.
Yeah, we love you, Dan. Take care, mate.
Yeah. Right, cheers, mate. Bye-bye.
Right, then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.